Blog Talk Radio.
Today, hope you're doing well. You know, most of these programs are supported by great books, good background material from the authors and the researchers who are on the program. But I like to make sure that people know that Facebook, our Facebook page, Earth Ancient, and we have two. We have an international page, and then we have a group page, supports a lot of the material. And when I say support, we have photo archives, we have information that comes up that supports the show. And 2 weeks ago, we had Ian Hudson, who's the author of, Who Discovered America. And in his discussion, he talked about this Chinese admiral, Zheng He, and we spoke a lot about him and his travels around the world. And it was interesting because Ian also supplied us with this map, and the map is approximately 5,000 years old, and it's attributed to the Chinese. We don't know if Zheng He, the admiral, used this map, but there's a great suspicion that he did. And the travels of this individual, as well as probably earlier Chinese, are chronicled in this book. Now, what is unique is about a week ago, I found a series of images of a Chinese individual that was found in the southwestern Mexican tomb. It's dated between 400 and 800 years old. This object, and it's of a Chinese individual with mustache and beard, beautifully reproduced. And I just thought, let's consider this as a potential individual who could have been well known. The reason I say that is that the various native tribes, Maya, Aztec, they would make molds of key individuals. And this is a beautiful reproduction of a Chinese individual, full beard, full mustache, and he's got it looks like some kind of a hat or headwear on that makes him look fantastic. And I think it's a very important find. You don't see, other than the Olmec, you don't see small figurines that are this beautifully rendered, and we think that it was probably part of a vase or a bowl of some kind, which is typical for natives in Mexico. But you can see three photographs of this Chinese individual on our Facebook page. Go to Facebook, Earth Ancients, go to group and check it out. It's very, very interesting. I sent a photograph to Ian, and he was kind of fascinated by it himself. He gets quite a few emails, and he's going to get back to me with some more information on it. Remember, he wrote the book, Who Discovered America, and based on the Chinese maps and their seafaring abilities. So that's something I want people to check out. The other thing that is notable is one of our members, Ernest Pfeiffer, posted a series of amazing photographs of Chaco Canyon. And in this series, there are photos of a number of ruins. Most notably, there's these are Anasazi sites. And these ruins have, I've never seen such an amazing selection of photographs. There's almost 100 of these photographs that he took about 15 years ago before they basically blockaded or limited the access to these various ruins in this area. And it's a great opportunity to see these the details of these buildings. And I was just blown away because many of the walls, many of the buildings are 30 to 40 feet high, and they are quite an engineering feat to consider. So something to check out. It's on Facebook. That's on the group page. You can see it Facebook. Go to Earth Ancients. Go to a group and see those photographs. Something really, really unique to check out. I have had a number of people on the show speaking about sacred journeys, vision quests. We had Graham Hancock on, and I actually was questioning him about his sacred journeying and his interest in using psychotropic plants for vision quests. And my guest today has written a book that I think you're going to be very interested in. Chris Kilham he's the medicine hunter, and he's featured on Fox News. He's a medicine hunter, author, educator. He's the founder of Medicine Hunter, Inc., and he's conducted medicinal research in over 40 countries, and he's written a number of books. And this book today we're going to talk about is fascinating. I found it from a friend who forwarded it to me. It's called The Medicine Hunter, The Ayahuasca Test Pilot's Handbook. And as we had spoken to Graham has been on a number of these journeys, but we just didn't get enough information. I mean, what is this all about? Why is it so popular? Are there problems involved in going on one of these journeys or vision quests? Is there, you know, are there shaman who are, you know, are all shaman good that you go to? Are all shaman positive in their approach to this, you know, this very personal exploration? And I would consider it a consciousness exploration, but we'll find out from our guest today. So I think this is something to really consider. Chris, I want to welcome you to the program. How are you today?
Very good, Cliff. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Fantastic. I'm really looking forward to this. You know, you've written a number of books on your travels around the world, and you've worked with a number of shaman. I mean, you really appear to really thrive in this environment. What is a medicine hunter specifically?
Well, in my instance, I travel around the world investigating different medicinal plants and so-called superfoods and psychoactive plants of all different types, and spend time in the cultures where these things originate so I can understand how they fit into those cultures. And then I also help to establish trade in many cases. A lot of what I work with in the Amazon or Siberia or the South Pacific or the Middle East, wherever I go, winds up in products all over the world. And I try to do it in a way that is environmentally friendly and also fair in terms of the wage practices for the people who do the hard work in the field. So this work gives me the opportunity to meet people of different cultures all over the world, to dive fairly deeply into their, ceremonies and practices and beliefs and their lifestyles and everything from their food to their medicine. So it's been a phenomenal experience for me to do this work, and it does give me the opportunity to explore the frontiers of consciousness in different countries and cultures.
Interesting. Now, is there a group of companies that funds your research so that they say, look, Chris, we're interested in a specific plant to help people, this and that? Do you actually go out in that capacity, or are you more of an independent researcher?
I do virtually all of this on behalf of companies. I forgot to be born a trust fund kid. It just sort of slipped my mind. So in order to do this travel and work, which costs money, I need companies to sponsor me. And I've had one company, a France-based company called NatureX, who's been pretty much my primary client for about 21 years, and other companies out there that have funded my work over the years as well. So, yeah, it really is for industry. And, it gives me the opportunity to move about and to explore these, various plant treasures.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. But you have a very interesting background. You've written books on meditation and yoga. You practice yoga quite a bit, which I think is fantastic. I'm a yoga person myself, and also I do meditate. And this kind of inner journey that you do really comes across in your book. I want to ask you, what do we know about older or ancient cultures and their use of psychotropic herbs and hallucinogens for vision quests? Do we have kind of an understanding of that?
Well, we have an understanding of these things. There are a few things to consider. For the most part, the psychoactive plant breadbasket is really South America. When you consider the psychoactive plants that exist around the world, the greatest number of them occur in South America, just as kind of an unusual environment that way. Doesn't mean that it's exclusively so. I mean, cannabis derived originally from northern Asia, and there are some species of plants there that are otherwise psychoactive. But the problem is that in South America, and especially in Amazonia and in the rainforest communities, there are no written records. So the earliest records that we have are accounts of priests and explorers who went into various tribal regions and learned about these things. We have some evidence with ayahuasca, for example, refering back to the title of my book, The Ayahuasca Test Pilot's Handbook. We have evidence of ayahuasca going back, over 1,500 years, residues in pot shards from Ecuador. But basically, we don't know how far back these things go, because unlike what we have in India or China or in the Middle East, we don't have any written record. We don't have anything on stone. There are no tablets. So a lot of this we just assume goes back thousands of years, but we really don't know when these practices started.
Interesting. It's funny because the indigenous cultures have more of an earth so-called Gaia connection than we do today. And the term vision quest is derived from various types of journeying. And I know from my connection with various elders in American and Maya groups that, this is a very, very important part of their culture. Is there something about this resurgence or growth in this ayahuasca journeying that do you think is kind of tapping into the need to reconnect? Or would you say it's just one of those things that's just really kind of cool right now and people are doing it in waves?
I think there are a lot of factors that have come together all at once at this particular time, Cliff. First of all, we see a softening of the, you know, kind of hard anti-psychedelic activity that we saw, you know, from the 70s on. There's much more information than there's ever been before. As you know, you can find out about almost anything with a quick Google search, or at least get started on that. So our access to knowledge and information has just exploded. I mean, we've never, in all of human history, we've never had access like this. And at the same time, I do think that as, you know, we stare at the, what is it, by 2030, a full 70% of all of humanity will be living in urban areas, so in cities, yeah. As people disconnect further and further and further away from natural environments from which we are all derived, I think there is this kind of deep innate longing, at least among some people, for reconnection. And whether you're using, you know, peyote or San Pedro cactus or ayahuasca or cannabis or any number of other psychoactive plants, those do help to facilitate a greater consciousness of nature. So I think there are a lot of factors at work, and also people realize that the sort of definition of reality that we kind of are given in school and our education and our basic passage into adulthood is at the very least vastly incomplete. There's a lot of information that's gotten left out. It's kind of like you walk into a house and you only ever spend time in the living room, but there are four bedrooms, a recreation room, a basement, an attic, you know, a sunroom. It goes on and on, you know, bathrooms galore. Our exposure to what is kind of reality is actually quite limited. And the appeal of reaching into a greater resource of the mind, into the world of spirit, into the world of plant spirit, journeying this way is very, very appealing to many people. So I think a lot of these things account for the popularity of psychedelics like ayahuasca at this time.
The late Terence McKenna spoke a great deal about journeying with various hallucinogens as a way to open the dimensions that are untappable, you can't grasp them under normal consciousness conditions. Do you think he had something to say? Do you believe that what he has to present is valid in today's society, where, you know, we don't really have an opportunity to explore unless we can use these powerful products?
Well, I don't think it's entirely correct. No, I mean, we do have opportunities to explore. You know, you do Sufi dancing for 3 hours, you're going to be high as a kite and in another dimension. You know, you go on a meditation retreat, you're definitely going to experience significantly altered states of consciousness. But I think that there is a speed and a thoroughness. You know, I mean, Terence, who I admire greatly, who was certainly a spellbinding speaker, was repeating what, you know, many thousands of people before him had already said about these agents, that they open up the gates of consciousness. I mean, The Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley being one of the great psychedelic books of all time, you know, and talking about how mescaline opened him to an entire other world. This is something that is oft repeated, and the thing about the psychedelics is that they are experiential. You can read about them, you can talk about them, you can hear about them, you can consider them, you can, you know, investigate them, whatever. But it's only when you put these things into your body, and you take that journey, that you actually have any sense at all of what they are. And what they are is remarkable. They're remarkable for their healing power. They're remarkable for their consciousness expanding capacity. They're remarkable for the dimensions of self that they open up to the person who takes the journey. In so many ways, they're astonishing. And so there are many people who, once they try the psychedelics, LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, ayahuasca, you know, go, wow, there is a whole other universe to explore. And they wind up being quite enthusiastic and intentional about that exploration.
Interesting. You know, this book, The Ayahuasca Test Pilot Handbook, is very in-depth. And I really appreciated what you covered in there. But I have to ask you, and by the way, you mentioned that you worked with 20 different shamans, and that's quite a few individuals. But what was your motivation for writing the book? Was it just the fact that you felt that there were people out there who were getting involved with people that were kind of shady? Was it the fact that there could have been people taking various derivatives of ayahuasca that weren't truly the real solid material? I mean, what was the purpose of writing the book?
Well, after a few years of drinking ayahuasca in the Amazon, you know, on my own, with friends, with my wife Zoe, in different groups, in different retreat centers with shamans, one of the things that was obvious was that there was constant ongoing conversation after and you know, sort of around these ceremonies about what this was. You know, there's an enormous amount of sharing that people do. And it seemed to me that while there are some very, very fine books out there on ayahuasca, I mean, Singing to the Plants, certainly a wonderful book. You know, Ayahuasca in My Blood, Peter Gorman's kind of hair-raising story about ayahuasca, that there wasn't an actual guide. There wasn't a spell it out, this is what it is, this is what it does kind of guide. And I like doing those kinds of things. I like being able to take a great deal of information and sort of distill it down and give it to people in a way that's hopefully also interesting and entertaining. And so, you know, having been part and parcel of probably, you know, a couple hundred of these conversations, I knew a lot about the questions that people had. So it was mostly because I saw an opening. You know, the French have an expression, cherchez le créneau, find the opening. And in this case, there was an opening for a real handbook to ayahuasca. And also, I do think that people sometimes wind up in the wrong circumstance or with the wrong shaman, and I wanted to help them to avoid doing that as well.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a very readable book. You write in a very comfortable, easy to understand, and very focused manner, which was made it kind of a fun book to look into. You know, I've been meditating for 20 years, and I find that it's kind of an interesting form of consciousness, and it really helps me in my daily focus and the arduous tasks of making a living and things like that. What am I missing something by not consuming ayahuasca? To be an advocate, and I don't know if it's a good term, but what would you say to somebody who is interested in it but just hasn't even considered it?
Well, I don't, you know, I don't think you're missing. No. I mean, this is something that if you're inclined, if you're interested, then it's worth checking out. Ayahuasca, like LSD or like magic mushrooms or like peyote or like San Pedro or whatever, it isn't for everybody, and I'm not one of those people who imagines that everybody could benefit from it. I don't believe that. I think that, you know, people are too unique one from another. But You know, I too am a meditator. I mean, I've been meditating pretty much daily for about 46 years, and meditation and yoga have been the mainstays of my spiritual practice. But I find that the addition of ayahuasca and the other psychoactive plants, you know, used thoughtfully and intelligently, is a terrific addition to that practice. You know, with yoga and meditation in general, what we get, except for some of the breakthrough aha moments, is kind of steady, ongoing daily maintenance and progress and, you know,
right.
Deeper capacity for voluntary control of involuntary functions and all that type of thing,
right.
While the psychedelics and ayahuasca being a real bobsled down Everest, for sure, are rapid, intense, and thorough. And so there's this difference that, I mean, for example, with going into meditation and let's say doing a heart chakra meditation, you can absolutely open up to, you know, love and compassion and really be, you know, dwelling in that heart center. And it's very satisfying and fulfilling. And when that happens on ayahuasca, the only thing in the entire universe is that love and compassion and that endless, gigantic, luminous ocean of light beaming out of the heart of all existence. And you are completely one and everything with that in the most thorough possible ways, down to the cells in your toenails. So the radical immersion of it is extraordinary. And it is because of that intensity and thoroughness that people can have breakthrough healing experiences. So my takeaway and kind of long-winded answer to your question is, it's not really a matter of you missing something, but I do think that the combination, the fusion of Eastern disciplines, meditation, yoga, Tai Chi, the martial arts, with the judicious, intentional use of the psychedelics is an extraordinary combination.
Do you believe that there actually is a consciousness in this combination of herbs, the extract? Because a number of people have actually said that the plants have a consciousness, and when it's extracted, at some level, it's communicating with you.
Well, what I think is that everything has an energetic fingerprint. And we know this to be so. I mean, we know that the fundamental elemental, you know, structure and energetic fingerprint and atomic weight and photon emission, let's say, of a rock is different than from a piece of sequoia bark, and that's different from a lily, and that's different from a hamburger. You know, these are all different things. And when part of the challenge that people have when they hear about sacred plant medicine is sort of this notion of plants, you know, plant spirits. It's kind of hard to grasp sometimes. Do I think that plants fundamentally have innate spirits? Yes, absolutely. Is that spirit perhaps inextricably intertwined with the fundamental DNA of those plants? Probably. So that would mean that if you were to have, let's say, natural ayahuasca, you know, made from the ayahuasca vine and the leaf that are put together to cook this brew that you drink, that would be fundamentally different from if you took just MAO inhibiting chemicals and DMT together to have what is referred to as a pharmahuasca journey. So yes, I think that the plant spirits are real, and at the same time, there's no obligation to accept that to take the ride.
That's fascinating. You know, early in your book, you describe the loss of your mother, the deep sadness that you felt that you hadn't had a chance to say goodbye, to be with her, and it was a shock to you, which you didn't realize until you know, later. And you took a journey to Peru, and you had the an ayahuasca session, and you had quite an interesting experience connecting with her. Can you describe that a little bit? I thought it was a fantastic look at actually levels of consciousness that we just don't access normally.
Well, sure. I, after grieving for about 14 months and just inconsolably so, you know, I realized I needed help outside of myself. And I actually contacted Dennis McKenna, who I've known for years, and said, hey, you know, what good shamans do you know who practice ayahuasca shamanism? And he gave me some names, and I went down to one place in the Peruvian Amazon, and the shaman asked me why I was there, and I said, you know, I want to get rid of this grief over my mother's death. It's been going on too long, and I also want my energy back. And he said, how long do you have? And I said, 3 nights. And he looked at me and said, oh, we can do that. And I thought that was very ambitious of him, but okay, you know, what do I know? It was my first time drinking that. And I mean, I'd had experience with other psychoactive and psychedelic agents, but so the very first night, there was kind of a comical moment where after I drank the ayahuasca, the shaman said to me, listen, you know, if it isn't strong enough, in another hour or so, you can have more. I just want to say that there was no part of me at any time further on in the evening that would have thought that drinking more was a smart idea. I was completely out of my skull on this stuff. And at one point, I was sort of fretting over that I wished I had a blanket because I didn't. And then that made me think of my mother always used to use an electric blanket, and that was just sort of a funny thing about her. And then the next thing I knew, I was sitting with her. And it was very normal. It wasn't, you know, psychedelic like purple and light streaming from the sky. It was just sitting on the porch with my mom. And she said, you know, it's pretty odd that you had to come down here to Peru and drink this stuff and throw up in a plastic bucket to get over your grief of my death. But you've always been different, and that's what I love about you. And we had this great conversation. And when the conversation was complete, the grief was completely and totally gone. And that was 10 years ago, and it never came back.
So that
speaks to the real healing nature. That's why ayahuasca is called la medicina, the medicine. That's why the magic mushrooms in traditional Mexican culture are called la medicina, the medicine. That's why peyote is called la medicina, the medicine. Yeah. They're all called the medicine because fundamentally these really are for healing.
That's the unique part of this that I want to talk to you about. You use the word medicine quite a bit in the book, and to my mind, medicine is something that heals or attempts to heal. And from your own personal journey, and I guess the definition from other people, this healing is done on a conscious level to bring forth imagery and sensations that are going to the deepest levels of an individual's consciousness to either eradicate issues or, I mean, how it's just fascinating. I can only describe it as a consciousness reliever. I mean, what else could it be? I mean, how do you describe this medicine?
Well, ayahuasca has the capacity to basically, I'm going to back up a little bit just to give you a good definition of healing so we can sort of be on the same page with this. Many years ago, I was speaking at an ethnobotany conference in Hawaii, and there was this wonderful, wonderful man who was a Hawaiian healer, and he said something I've never forgotten. He said, true healing puts into order the body, mind, and spirit with the past, the present, and the future. And if you think about that broad definition of healing, then you're talking about physical, mental, emotional healing, any and all traumas. And what we know is that pretty much anything that we experience, you know, registers in our brains. And if we have reactions and responses, whether it's grief, sadness, anger, hostility, resentment, rage, you know, suspicion, whatever it might be, that these make neural pathways, actually like a little electrical pathways that fire again and again in our brains. And we know from studies that have been conducted on various psychedelics in recent years that during the experience with these medicines, those neural pathways are suspended. So you don't have the same stress reaction, the same traumatic experience, whatever it is. And that allows you to naturally form newer, healthier, more wholesome life-imbuing habits, whatever they might be. So this might help you to overcome chronic fatigue, a chronic headache, chronic stomach aches, unresolvable grief, post-traumatic stress, the trauma as a result of being, you know, physically abused, sexually abused, any number of things that can happen to people that cause great grief and hardship in their lives. And so this is where the real power of ayahuasca specifically and the other psychedelics like peyote, is extraordinary. This is something that our other medicines cannot do. So this whole dimension of body-mind healing really is at this point in time accessible only with these agents and unusual yogic methods.
That's a pretty heavy discussion, a pretty heavy description of breaking neural pathways for negative conditioning and then freeing somebody up to have more healthy thinking, thoughts, and vibrations. I don't know of anything else out there that does that. What are the properties of ayahuasca? Can you tell us a little bit about the various herbs that make it up?
Sure. Ayahuasca is the only combinatory hallucinogen in the world. So whereas, if you're taking peyote, you eat peyote buttons, or San Pedro, you have some of that cactus, ayahuasca requires a preparation involving a vine that sometimes by itself is referred to as ayahuasca, and also a leaf. And the vine contains compounds that inhibit a system in our body is called the MAO system, the monoamine oxidase system. And the leaf contains DMT. And if you know much about DMT at all, it's the most potent psychoactive agent we know of. It's something that is manufactured in microscopic quantities in our own bodies. It may be the agent that releases at the end of death and kind of sends people off into the very commonly referred to, you know, sort of like tunnel of infinite light. If we take DMT orally, just plain DMT, nothing happens, nothing at all. But if we take it with an MAO inhibitor, like the compounds in the ayahuasca vine, then we can have a very, very powerful journey. So in the Amazon rainforest, where ayahuasca derives, ingenious native pharmacologists thousands of years ago selected out of about 80,000 different plants this one vine and this one leafy bush and put those together and cooked them down to make this novel psychoactive healing brew, ayahuasca, a rather remarkable discovery.
It is amazing. The only thing I would ask you is, after so many thousands of years, is there any way to eliminate the reaction of the first, I guess it's the first 20 minutes or whatever, when there's retching and other bodily functions that are kind of like crazy? Because has the same issue there.
Yes. In point of fact, there are people, for example, who make what I referred to earlier, make pharmahuasca. They take plants or chemicals that are, you know, MAO inhibiting and DMT containing, and put them together and make an ayahuasca-like preparation. And some of these don't cause any nausea at all. I know a shaman who takes ayahuasca and evaporates it down and crushes and pulverizes it into a powder. But for the most part, it is drunk as this dark, mysterious, rather nasty tasting stuff. And the majority of people, not everybody, you know, tend to throw up within the first hour. I mean, my wife Zoe rarely does, for example. I do pretty much all the time, with rare exception. You know, it just depends. You kind of come to accept that part of the ride as part of the ride.
Mm-hmm. Because the benefits overshadow any kind of physical problems that you have in the first hour.
Well, also there's something else. You know, ayahuasca, among its many names, it's known as La Purga, the purge. And very often, you know, you might, for example, drink ayahuasca, and then after a half hour, 40 minutes or whatever, you feel, oh gosh, I really need to throw up. And at the same time that you do, you may also have the very, very real experience of also vomiting out or purging negativity, bad habits, shame, guilt, fear, whatever, kind of toxic reactions and feelings and emotions. So it isn't just that you physically vomit and that most people don't really enjoy doing that. It's that the purge itself may be every bit as much a psychic purge as it is the physical act of throwing up the ayahuasca that's in your stomach.
Now, that's the first time I've heard that, and I find that extremely fascinating. Like, it's like a purging toxins, purging negative habits. I mean, did that come down to you, that revelation? That's a huge piece of information that I think is quite unique.
It's actually part and parcel of the shamanic teachings around ayahuasca, you know, and many people will say, God, you know, I was having this terrible vision about whatever, you know, something that happened in my childhood, and then I had this terrible urge to throw up, and when I did, I threw up my toxic reaction to the way I'd been treated by my siblings, blah, 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 blah. I mean, you hear that all the time, Cliff. You hear that from so many people. So the purging, which could be, I mean, I'll give you another example. I have on numerous nights found myself sitting or lying down in ayahuasca ceremony with tears streaming down my face like my eyes are little water taps, just running, actually running, and I'm not sad, and I'm not crying. And that purging, what we know is that the greatest concentration of stress hormones in the entire body is found in tears. And so one of the things that ayahuasca does is it reduces the stress hormones in your body. So that may mean that you have this free-flowing tap. You're basically purging these stress chemicals out of the tears in your eyes. Or you may have tremendously extreme urge to move your bowels and you know, feel that you've, you know, not only done that, but also shat out, you know, all kinds of psychic and, you know, other sort of like vile emotional mental toxins that don't serve you anymore. So it's a big part of the ayahuasca experience.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that following an experience, there's an elevation in consciousness, you have more clarity? I mean, it may just be temporary, but do you find, or would you say, and maybe you can't say this, but would you say it's an evolutionary kind of a experience?
Well, I think that very often you do feel more mentally clear, more refreshed. I mean, it depends, mm-hmm. you know, not every not every night in an ayahuasca ceremony is a fun ride. So you might in fact the next day go, whoa, man, I totally got destroyed last night. I mean, that also can happen. But I would say that overall people do feel refreshed, reinvigorated, you know, cleansed of things that are toxic and don't serve them really. And that's the reason that people go through the discomfort or, you know, the unease of the experience. Because sometimes ayahuasca, I mean, sometimes you're just bathed in a, you know, a swimming pool of endless light and bliss and joy, and you just spend your entire night, you know, sending love vibes out to everybody you've ever known or can think of. And other nights, you know, your head is down in the chipper shredder and you're just being pulverized. You never know what you're going to get.
That's amazing. One of the important parts of your book, and I'm really glad you wrote this, is about the ayahuasca shaman, you know, how to find these people, what makes a good, unique experience a shaman. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think, and I read about this, that there's so much interest in this subject that there's fly-by-night shaman, I'll call them, for lack of a better word, people that maybe... And you actually describe it, people, shaman, or people who have had one or two experiences and all of a sudden they put out their shield and call themselves a shaman. What's the best criteria?
I mean, you know, I like to use the example of dentistry. I mean, you can go to Home Depot and you can buy a Dremel tool and some liquid porcelain. And you can, in fact, drill your own teeth out and cover them up with porcelain and, you know, deal with a cavity. But most of us are going to go to a dentist because that person is trained and experienced and knows how to do it in a way that's safe and that yields the best results. And it really is the same with shamans. I mean, this is a traditional training. This is something that it's no different from any other really good skill. You know, if you're a fine cabinet maker, you don't just get up one day as a kid and grab a hammer and start making beautiful furniture. You know, it takes decades to become a master. And so too with shamanism, learning to be a trance master, learning to work with the medicine, learning to establish a journey that has a beginning and a middle and an end and takes people out to some very, very, very wild states of consciousness and brings them back safely. This is a real talent and skill. And it is the case that some people, you know, drink a couple of times and they go, oh, yeah, you know, whatever. I got the word from all above and I should be a shaman and I can heal everybody and blah, blah, blah. I mean, people are going to be delusional anytime you have, you know, something like this. It's going to happen. And you also have people who go, gee, you know, there's a lot of money to be made and I could really get laid a lot if I were a shaman in the right situation. And there's all that going on, too. So you do need to know who you're drinking with, who's officiating the ceremony, who are they, what's their training, how long have they been doing this. You know, you go to somebody like Don Alberto Davila at Blue Morpho, who's done like 6,000 ceremonies. You are in the hands of a very, very finely talented person. And you get somebody who went down there for 2 weeks and drank 8 times and came back with a jug of ayahuasca that they got from somebody down the road. And, you know, they start leading ceremonies and you might have a really hilariously awful experience as a result of their complete ineptitude and lack of training and their delusional imaginations about who they are.
Mm-hmm. So what is the good criteria? I mean, just real basic without having to give us a long detail. But, I mean, obviously somebody who's practiced it. But, I mean, more than just practicing, a shaman is a unique individual. And he can actually, from what I've read in your book and some other books, he can actually almost see how an individual or a participant is reacting to the medicine. What did you say?
Well, yeah, I mean, shamans are trained to read energy, and there are times on ayahuasca in the medicine space, when you see the energy around people very, very clearly, it's, oh, okay, that's what they're talking about. I get all those points of light and those colors coming off these people. That's what they mean. They are trained to work with the medicine. They are sensitive to how people react because they have experience. So when you want to find a shaman, how long have they been doing it? Who trained them? What's their reputation? You know, are they known as somebody who plays it totally squeaky clean? Are they known as somebody who's a manipulator? If they're a manipulator, if they're a sexual predator, if they have, you know, a reputation as being some sort of a fool of some sort, don't drink with them. Find somebody good. It's worth it. You know, you want to have a good experience. You're remarkably psychically vulnerable during these situations. You want to be in the right hands. Just as you don't want to get up into a commercial airline that they said, you know, today we thought that instead of having a pilot fly the 747 to Tokyo, we're going to have our pal Ben. You know, he's a really nice guy, and he played football with a couple of us in college. And you go, just, I'm getting off this plane right now. You know, you want people who are trained, who really know what the heck they're doing.
Right. But wouldn't you say that you really have to leave the United States to experience like the top shaman? They're not in the United States, are they? You have to be down
some,
in Peru.
Well, some shamans do come into the United States and do come into Europe periodically. Some of the really fine ones have done that. But for the most part, pretty much the epicenter of ayahuasca culture right now is, that is traditional use, is in Peru, for example, where you can go to any number of centers like Nihui Rao or Temple of the Way of Light or Dream Glade or Ayahuasca Foundation, you know, some of these good places. And be in the hands of capable, talented shamans, be in a safe environment, a non-predatory environment, and get the healing and the journeying that you long for.
Yeah, I would think that you really have to do your research because you are vulnerable. I mean, because this thing is opening you up. Especially if you're brand new to it, you're probably like extremely vulnerable to the environment you're sitting in.
And it depends on what experiences you've had. I mean, I would not say that LSD and ayahuasca are really perfectly comparable. You know, as a teenager, I had actually quite a bit of experience with LSD, and I've been in some Native American peyote ceremonies and have done some journeying with things. So there was some familiarity with some dimensions of what ayahuasca is about. Well, on the other hand, I hadn't ever experienced anything like it. But I think if you were new to the whole thing, then it's extreme enough without having to deal with a talentless or poorly intentioned shaman.
Can you describe an ayahuasca ceremony and why it's, I mean, because they're all kind of a little different, but isn't there like a key foundation to a ceremony, like calling in spirits or whatever? I mean, because these shaman are working, I would think, on different dimensions than what we live in.
Okay. There is, with any really good journey, there is a beginning and a middle and an end. In a typical ayahuasca ceremony, my wife Zoe and I go down to Peru and we drink with these various shamans, and the basic sort of structure of the ceremony remains largely the same, one shaman to another, that at a certain time, everybody gets together in the ceremonial space. The shaman, you know, settles down. The ayahuasca is brought out. There's a glass that is typically used or a cup, and people are called up one by one, and they drink a certain amount of ayahuasca. And when that's done, most of the time how it goes is you kind of settle into silence for a while. And then you start to feel the ayahuasca coming on, and maybe in about 45 minutes or so, the shaman or shamans, because sometimes there are two, three, four, even five shamans in a single ceremony, will begin to sing. They will sing healing songs that are known as Ikaros. And these are somewhat eerie, usually very pleasing, strange songs, and they may be slow and mournful, or they might be really kind of fast and strange. They vary over the course of the night. And the idea with the shamans is that they spend the time between the drinking and the singing doing their own kind of inner protections and protections on each other. And then when they start to sing, they're bringing the medicine, so to speak, into the ceremonial space. And the journey really has to do with carrying people deep into the medicine, making sure that they're, you know, mareado, that is, they're feeling the effects quite strongly so the medicine can really work on them. And then over the course of several hours, there'll be a lot of this singing interspersed with some quiet periods to kind of give people like a little bit rest. It's sort of the ceremony energy kind of goes up and down a little bit. And gradually toward the end of the evening, which can, you know, if you drink at 8, an evening can end at 1 or 2 or 3 or sometimes even as late as 4, there'll be sort of the final songs, and then the ceremony will be declared over for that evening. And, you know, you may have quite a ride during the intervening hours between when you drink from the glass and when it's all said and done.
Mm-hmm. So there's no average time for an experience. It depends on the individual's chemistry and what state of mind they're in. Or does it typically run 2, 3, 4 hours for a journey?
I would say that the average ceremony is probably, 5, 6 hours long.
That's pretty good. Yeah,
and in the dark, not done in daylight, not done with candles or lights on, but in the evening dark, whether it's a starlit, moonlit night or it's not.
Do you think that this the growth of this, ceremony journeying, is derived because people are, it's like another kind of a drug, or do you think it's actually deeper than that, where people are saying, I need to get in touch with another part of myself, and I'm seeking this out, and I want somebody to help me journey? I mean, what would you say?
I think it's all of the above. I think some people go, wow, that sounds incredible. I want to try that. I want to experience that. Mm-hmm. And it can be pure curiosity. It can be that people have tried other psychedelics, but they've heard that, ayahuasca is somewhat of a whopper and they want that notch in their psychedelic belt. It can be that somebody says, I've been dealing with this trauma forever, and I've done psychiatry, and I've taken Xanax and Klonopin and all this crap, and I'm tired of it, and I want something better, and nothing's really worked for me, and I hear this might be helpful, and that's why they go. It's 1,000 reasons. There's no one reason, but I would say that more people go initially to resolve or heal something than for any other purpose. And many's the person who's gone for curiosity, reverently, like, I want to experience this, and, approaching it with great respect, who might find an hour into it, wow, I didn't realize I have this kind of big thing that I can deal with here and help to get some healing with. That can happen, too.
That's what makes it so fantastic. It's how it touches those deep recesses of the brain, of the mind, whereas LSD and some of those other psychotropics maybe do that to a degree. But this has, and I think I've read, reports on other psychotropics that you do get a sense of consciousness aiding you, but there's more of it here with ayahuasca. Ayahuasca seems to be, from what I read, that it's like the supreme consciousness aid to kind of therapeutically move you through levels of consciousness. It's fascinating.
It's certainly quite intense. And you know, there's something that just getting back to the brain, neurologists estimate that the number of connections that can be made between the neurons, the nerve cells in our brain, exceeds the number of atoms in the universe. That is, we have these billions and billions of neurons, and making a connection from one to another, that there's virtually an infinitude of possibilities. So let's just assume that that's even half right, okay? Half the atoms in the whole universe. That's a lot. The point is that if you can suspend the neural pathways as we described, then basically you wind up in a state of infinite consciousness and infinite possibility. And many's the person who has taken ayahuasca who at some point has just dissolved into this sense of the pure infinite. And that is, I think, realistic not only to the actual nature and high capability of the mind, but also of the greater existence in which we find ourselves. It really is an actual infinitude in which we live.
Wow, that's a lot. Hey, you know, Chris, this has been great. I really appreciate you joining me on the program. What in the final minutes that we have here, what would you like to be the takeaway on this book, this amazing book on ayahuasca? What are your hopes for the reader?
Well, I would hope that readers would be informed by the Ayahuasca Test Pilot's handbook, that they would be entertained a bit, that they would find answers to questions, maybe find questions that they didn't know to ask. You know, I would hope that it would satisfy them somehow and fulfill a need. This is a psychedelic healing is a wonderful dimension of medicine overall, and it is kind of coming into its own at this point in time. And I think that for those who are interested in ayahuasca or just want to know about it, you know, whether or not they're going to drink in the near future or not, the Ayahuasca Test Pilot's handbook can help them to get an enormous amount of information in a very short period of time.
Fantastic. My guest has been Chris Kelham. The book is The Ayahuasca Test Pilot's Handbook, The Essential Guide to Ayahuasca Journeying. And I think from what I've read, and I haven't read the entire book, but the chapters and the breakout, it's probably the most thorough look at this entire phenomenon of journeying with this plant extract. Chris, thank you very much for being my guest. And
Thank you, Cliff, and just to remind your listeners that they can go to my website, which is medicinehunter.com, and they'll get information about the book and also about hundreds of other medicinal plants.
Fantastic. And the book's now available on, or has been available on Amazon, but if they went to your site, could they order it there also?
Actually, if they go onto medicinehunter.com, they'll get links to places like Amazon. We don't sell anything ourselves, but we link to the places that sell, you know, my books and also some of the nutritional products that I'm also involved with.
Fantastic. Chris, thank you very much. It was very informative talking with you.
Thank you, Cliff. You take really good care. It's been a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you. That's Chris, and he is Chris Kelham, and he is the author of this amazing book. I strongly urge you to take a look at it. His website is also quite interesting, too. He has quite a diverse background and has been doing consciousness work for a long, long time. I want to remind everyone that I am looking for interns. If you're interested in supporting Earth Ancients and our growing network and like to be an intern, if you're in the continental U.S. or Canada or actually in North America, I'd like to hear from you. I'm looking for people who are actually competent on the internet, can do research, can work with us as we grow with our different hosts. And if you're interested, send me an email, cliff@earthancients.com. www.chinesetalk.com, and I will consider you. And it's there's opportunities for a lot of information coming your way and supporting the various other hosts that we are presenting on the program. So that's it for today, and I hope you have a great day yourself. Take care.